This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you very much. The public procurement regulations, you just love them, don't you? Fantastic. Really there to make your life easy. I'm going to make this a little bit technical, but very briefly so, because I think it's important you understand some technical issues about it before we then perhaps open the discussion up in a more and look at the more legally interesting things, if there are such a thing. It's very important for us to remember what the public procurement regulation system is about. It's not about value for money. It derives its roots from the European directive and the European treaties, whose aim is to create a totally open internal market. And in the Alice in Wonderland world of the Eurocrat, the idea is that ultimately every public body will be able to take its pens from Romania, it'll be able to get its health services from companies in Germany. It will be a total, and vice versa. British companies will participate in providing services to companies in Austria. And when the public procurement regulations were first brought in, they were a bit of a laugh, really. And I remember working in authorities, and you'd go along, you'd say to the people, and people are doing the hard stuff, like buying hard materials, that turn around and say, yeah, very important public procurement regulations. Nothing's really going to happen, is it, if we don't do them? And you go along to the people in the social services, social environment area, and they'd say, Part B services, mate, not a problem, doesn't apply to us. And the reason for that is when the regulations were brought in, originally the directive, it differentiated between two types of procurement. What they call Part A procurement, which is hard procurement, building bridges, regeneration, supplies, buying your speakers, stationery, and what was viewed as soft procurement, or non-priority services, to give it its technical name, which was areas around health, education, and surprisingly, the law. Wonder who kept that one in reserve. And the idea being that those Part B services would be not ruled in such a rigorous way. And certainly from 2006 to 2009, it's fair to say that the public procurement regulations in this country, in my view, were implemented with more of a sort of nod than they were seriously. But that landscape changed a lot in 2009 with the implementation of what's called the Remedies Directive, which amended the public procurement regulations and brought in some very, very tasty penalties for public bodies. Fines, contracts can be shortened, a thing called a declaration of ineffectiveness, which said the whole thing was just void. And it created a whole different climate. But you went back again to the social services people and they said, oh, it didn't sound too good. But of course you are obliged to tell them that the Remedies Directive only applies in a very limited way to the social enterprise, the social and health and education area. And so of course they kind of amended their ways, but in a sort of half-hearted sort of way. But nevertheless, this sort of Part B protection, which is where people have always relied in the health and education area to prevent them being caught by full procurement process, is under significant threat. And the reason for that is because when it was first brought in, the idea of public procurement regulation, the Part B service, the EU was predominantly a Western European setup. With the emergence of what's known as the transition economies, the economies of the former Soviet bloc, and the joining into within the EU, the old Part B justification of limited or no cross-border interest has disappeared. And there's an interesting example of that. If you look at Austria, which is a high-value Western economy, it's bordered by Hungary, Slovakia, other Eastern Europe, Slovenia. These Eastern European countries have created, quite rightly, I suppose, a huge fuss and said, look, in Austria, there's a hospital. We would like to bid for your privatised health support services. Now, under Part B, we can't do that, because you can keep that, not full regulation there, you see. But we're only a mile across the border, 2 miles across the border, and the company you're using is in Vienna, which is 200 miles away. So why can't we bid for that? And of course, the EU's taken this on board and recently issued a green paper. That green paper has proposed the abolition of the difference between Part A and Part B services. And the reason for my rather convoluted little dance around this is to make the point to you that those public procurement regulations are likely to get worse before they get better, because if that Part B differential goes, then it's going to have a big effect. Recently, we had an interesting example late last year in Ireland, where a Northern Irish service was put out, security. It was a Part B service. The Southern Irish company bid. There were lots of issues around it. And the judge in Northern Ireland said, well, actually, it's a Part B service, but I'm going to set this procurement aside because it's potential cross-border interest. So we've got an emerging area there. So when you talk to people in the social, particularly in that social area where you're going to be bidding as a potential provider, and they think to themselves, well, we haven't really got to play it by the game, then that game is going to alter. Leaving that on one side, I'd then like to look at how, as I alluded to earlier, we're going to see the implementation of these big society ideas and the legal structure around that. Currently, within the public procurement regulations, there are certain exemptions. These exemptions allow you to reserve 20% of your contracts for what are called SMEs, you know, small, medium-sized enterprises. Now, it's a kind of coded word, that 20% and the what's this exemption, because what it really means is you can reserve for local businesses. The Europeans would never let you say that, and you'd probably get done if you did, because you're being discriminatory. But it does give a nice window. Now, you'd think to yourself, therefore, wouldn't you, that majority of contracts would be excluded under the 20% rule, that people would encourage social enterprise mutuals to bid for these things. But it doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen for a very good reason, that the public authorities don't employ staff who, A, have either heard of it, B, know how to do it, or C, are confident enough in their own skills that they could administer a scheme which would not be subject to challenge. And it's also cumbersome because, in a sense, if I've got a big project and I can only award 20% to a small supplier, the big supplier's got to work with the small supplier to deliver. And the law doesn't cope for that synergy. And big suppliers have a vested interest in saying to local authorities or to public bodies in general, we don't want you to do that 20%. You don't know what behind-the-scenes conversations take place, but there's a real issue there. Now, it does work. I mean, it's worked very well in Scotland. The Glasgow Housing Association started to tinker around with it, and they've done stuff with it. It's worked well as well in Wales, but I'm not aware that it's really ever worked to any extent within England. So, again, we have that potential area. Now, but the government and Parliament in general has looked to kind of supplement that, and we have two or three key bills going through. Two are private members' bills, and one is a government bill. The big government bill is the localism bill, which we've all heard of. The two private members' bills are the public services social enterprise bill and also the apprenticeship and skills bill. The social enterprise bill is a vehicle which seeks to set up a national strategy and promoting engagement with local business, with help with enterprise generally. In other words, it's a kind of vehicle that puts a local authority under a duty to look at the public procurement regulations and the European directives as they stand and implement things like those 20% reservations I've referred to. It could also be interpreted as saying that they should be required to use or adjust the criteria for the contract award to reflect local issues in a nice sort of way, but in a non-discriminatory way. That bill is progressing reasonably well for a private member's bill, and I suspect, and you may know more about this than me, that the government is probably putting some support behind it.
Not sure.
Okay, okay. The second bill is an odder bill. It's the Apprenticeship and Skills Bill. It's, again, private members. It's made its first couple of readings. It's a Labour sponsored, well, the first one was a Conservative private members' bill. This is a Labour private members' bill. But it's not been kicked out, and it's got to quite a healthy stage for a private members' bill. And this is looking to ensure that public bodies and local authorities reserve, when they award a major construction contract, a proportion, or ensure that contractors train locals up in skills which are pertinent to that particular project. And why I think these two bills are important in the legal context of social enterprise and its allied animals is that they're showing an awareness that you can do things if you're constructive with public procurement regulation to ensure that it does engage with that sector. But of course, these laws are great. They sit there and they do, and we know, because we're here talking about them, the potential of what could happen. But the people who administer those regulations, the procurement officers themselves, they have a problem with them because, as I said earlier, they're probably not aware of them. And they have a lot of myths around them. They have the myth that, you know, if we do this, we're always going to be challenged. Well, the reality is that low-value contracts, the big operators in that sector, aren't going to be that interested. The second myth, I think, that's around them is that when we look at potential bids by social enterprise mutuals, that they're not able to satisfy our base criteria. And what I mean by that is, you know, when I alluded earlier to the schools project, where they're all going to come together to create a mutual, they obviously want to have a financial profile. And one of the key areas for this kind of work is that you can show that you have the financial profile to deliver the contract. And again, there's a risk-averse approach from a local authority because they want to know that they can do this. Now, I've heard some imaginative solutions around that. And one of the ones, which is quite interesting, was a very, very big project where a mutual was to be established to take over the major social aspects of a county council. And and this is ongoing, and I'm obviously not going to say who it is, but the deal is that the mutual will be set up and the county council will make a three-month advance payment and therefore guarantee them a cash flow. Now, the legalities of that, another issues, and SIP probably has issues about it, but I'm just saying that's the kind of thought processes that people are having. And it's very important when you look at this and you say to yourself, well, you know, we've got this criteria, we've got this financial criteria, I am a procurement officer, I'm not happy about it. It's basically a gateway rejection to a project. I take that provider out because at that outset, I'm under pressure to deliver. Julian's alluded to timescales. Against the set timescale, I haven't got time to muck around seeing if these people are actually able to fit my criteria, because I've got people who are bidding for this contract who I know have got good criteria. And the public procurement regulations do not assist in that area at all, and it's a big problem for them. There's also a myth about including social requirements in procurement isn't legal. And this is, to a large extent, being addressed by the Localism Bill. I don't know how familiar any of you are with the Localism Bill, but if you are familiar, you'll be aware that it triggers, in certain circumstances, a procurement can be triggered if there's a sufficiently interested group of employees, sufficiently interested local group, on a council service. And the council has to consider whether or not they will put that service out. As I said to you earlier when we were talking, the regulations for this are not yet published. And then I don't like the expression, but the truth of the matter is that the devil is in the detail. And until we know what those regulations are going to say, it's going to be very hard for us to assess how effective that's going to be in assisting social enterprise and mutuals. What's interesting is the bill has gone through in the various stages of committee. It started out with a bald procurement exercise, but that's now been amended in the past few weeks to include a consideration for local requirements. And what's important to bear in mind is the Localism Bill, of course, triggers a procurement potentially. It doesn't necessarily mean it can alter the EU procurement regulations. So those requirements will always probably relate to below threshold areas. And another area that, again, is key, but again, local authorities are reluctant to address, and you can bring pressure to bear on this through your politicians, is to ensure that when procurement is being undertaken, that their own internal financial standing orders, or their own internal procurement regulations, because they'll have their own below threshold regulatory framework as well, that forces the procurement team, or the finance department, or wherever it sits, to take into account the areas that are open below threshold. So in other words, you can discriminate below threshold. If we just forget that being about cross-border interest, which, as I say, it really only applies above the threshold and applies at the moment to Part A services, it would be possible for you to always put in a requirement to service locally. And I have seen that done. So you can give local preference, but you've got to put it in the regulation because the procurement officer will not necessarily take any regard to it. And then we return back, in a sense, in a huge circle to one of the opening points I made when we started this discussion, that really it comes back to the training the procurement officer gets in procurement and the training the lawyers who advise the council get in procurement regulation. And all those issues are the key issues that need to be addressed if you're to take this model forward. Thank you.
Okay, great. Any, just before Jack sits down, any questions for clarification, not of substance, but questions for clarification about what Jack said. Just one, yeah.
Martin Pilkington again, OH Environmental. The European Court of Justice, though, is going to look and say, our brief is ever closer union. And then you want to give this particular piece of business to a local enterprise, mutual, cooperative, whatever. Mm. Have you really thought that there might be somebody in Italy that wants to do this?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. And as I said, I alluded to the Alice in Euroland world, and it is that. And the ECJ has that view. Although, having said that, towards the end of last year, there was a case called Wall, which is it's about a thing called service concessions. I won't bore you with the ins and outs of it. But they did reiterate that Part B services currently, and until legislation changes, should be dealt seen as Part B services, and national administration should have a degree of flexibility in the which they impose it. So, and that was quite reassuring, because the case law in the 18 months up to that had been going quite the other way, that we don't see that Part B really has a justification. But the trouble with all ECJ decisions is that they do stand on their particular facts, and they're very, very, it's a very difficult court to follow. They're not always very consistent.
Commission issued at the end of last year a document about procuring socially. Mm. And so recognising that there is also another factor in here, which is the European social model, and that there needs to be balance between the two things.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, but the because it's a tripartite organisation, one of the problems with the EU is that you have on the one hand the Commission, which has agendas, you have the Court, which interprets them, you have Parliament, which kind of lives in another world altogether. And the Commission is very inconsistent at times. It publishes that kind of stuff. And then when it goes to court, the Advocate General has a totally different attitude to it. And there seems to be no synergy between the Commission, the Advocate General, who's meant to represent the face of European justice, if you like, put his opinion before the court, and the court adopts those opinions in 80% of decisions. So it's there's a lack of synergy.
At the back?
Craig Eden Phillips from Stepping Out. With a lot of the health and social care world, there's not often an international dimension to procurement. What's happening in cases where you've got UK different types of UK providers, the small, the local, the mutual, versus larger, potentially international, but just larger, much larger UK organisations, where there isn't that European dimension. Mm. What's happening then with in examples and case law around what local authorities are actually finding themselves willing to do?
Well, case law wise, most of the UK procurement cases tend to be on fairly esoteric areas around criteria and things of that kind. There isn't an awful lot of case law in that given area, because these smaller organisations don't really have the funding to challenge the decisions. It costs a lot of money to mount a case. Let me give you let me explain. In Europe, the majority of European countries have an independent procurement review body. It's an organisation that sits a bit like our industrial tribunals, if you like, but a lot faster and a lot less controversial. But essentially, if you want to challenge a procurement, you pop down to the local office of this organisation and you say, hey, I don't like the look of this. It's broken EU rules, it's broken the local rules or whatever. And they're under duties to deliver answers very, very quickly. Now, the UK and a number of other countries do not have that. They rely on their own courts to implement procurement regulation. Now, as any of you know who've ever been involved in a court case, any case is expensive. And believe me, procurement barristers are very expensive. So if you're a small organisation and you want to challenge something, even within the UK, you've got to have a big fighting fund. If we had, like most Europeans have, this independent procurement review body, then we would be in a much, much better position. And it's interesting, when the Germans first introduced theirs in about 2002, they went from having very limited challenges to public procurement decisions to quite significant levels. I think the last time I looked at the stats, they'd jumped from something like 1,500 in the first year to 6,000 over the period of 3 years, because people were regularly challenging procurement decisions.
Jack, I'm just wondering, is it worth mentioning TECL in this regard? Just because
I hoped you were.
Because I've heard it described as a kind of a way of local authorities and other organisations, public organisations, kind of creating a shadow organisation, providing support to a new mutual before it's spinning out. I'm just wondering if it's worth saying anything on that.
That's a route I've heard used. It's not one I'm particularly happy with my lawyer's hat on. And there's a reason for that. There's a thing called a rule in TECL. And the rule in TECL says that if an organisation is established by a public body, which is separate to that public body, but carries out the bulk of its functions with that public body, then it is exempt from the public procurement regs. And a good example would be you decide to set up a separate waste organisation. You don't call it what Blockshire County Council's waste. You call it some sexy name like, you know, Binme or something. Mm-hmm. And that organisation is owned by the council. It can even be organised by... owned by about seven or eight different councils, and they all participate in this. And their procurement of that organisation for that service is fine. But the rule in TECL is complicated by the fact, and I can't remember the name of the case, I think it's CSRL case of a couple of years back, where the European Court of Justice said, well, if you set an organisation, a TECL compliant organisation up, with the intention of then privatising it, that is a breach of the rule in TECL. And equally, if you're really cute and you don't FOI it, you make sure your documents are FOI proof, but someone finds out that was always the intention, you're stuffed again. So I don't buy that TECL route.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Just one last question, then we're going to move on to Stephen's presentation. Yeah.
Alex Rosenthal from I was just wondering, when, as you mentioned, the TECL and the TECL exemption, and I think recent case law, as you mentioned, would imply that any private sector ownership would ensure that you fall foul of the TECL exemption. So therefore, that which you mentioned earlier, that I think it was 51% employee-owned, that was the expected amount, would it not then follow that any mutual would automatically fall foul of the TECL exemption, and then therefore, if you are above the threshold, you would have to publicly procure?
Yeah, I mean, that's an issue that's already happened. I read some time ago a reference to, I think it was the Liverpool Ambulance Service, who'd actually put out several years ago, their ambulance service to a mutual which had been formed for the employees. But the chap who was doing the presentation that I'd been reading about was the MD of this organisation, and said, of course, we do have to then rebid for the work when it comes up. Mm. So again, yes, that's a very fair point.
All right. Okay, we're going to move on now. Thank you very much indeed again, Jack.